Since this is Around Cincinnati, let's start with the local connection to our next guest, P. Craig Russell. He's a graduate of the University of Cincinnati, and over the years, he has contributed many truly amazing pages to the art of graphic storytelling. You may have seen his work on superhero books like Batman and Doctor Strange. He also adapted the work of British fantasy writer Michael Moorcock and the operatic epics of Richard Wagner. Some of Russell's best-known art these days is seen in collaboration with another UK writer, Neil Gaiman, like the Sandman zine, and that's for the Vertigo imprint, and a graphic novelization of Coraline. P. Craig Russell has just released his latest, a deluxe graphic novel of Gaiman's The Graveyard book. Anybody who's seen your work over the years knows that there's a lot more going than just the usual pen and ink, the pen and line drawings we see in comics. And you got a painting degree from UC. Has that done a lot for your approach over the years?
No, it's hardly impinged on it at all. I've rarely painted since then. And while I did learn a lot in art school at Cincinnati that I've been able to apply to my work, it was more in the area of design, the use of negative space, line work, all of that sort of thing. Not too much in painting, a little training in color. Actually, when I colored my first story at Marvel Comics, and I asked if I could because they were going to give it to someone who was not a good colorist at all, and I made my case for my coloring it, the head colorist, Marie Severin, said, "Do you know anything about color?" And I said, "That's all I studied for 4 years in art school," which was a whopper. But it got me my first job in coloring, and I was home free after that.
I wish that this wasn't radio, because there's so much we could talk about in the art world, the art field, that we can't really show on radio.
Of course.
But the way you draw, there seems to be kind of like a classical art basis in your style.
Oh, that is partly because of my education at UC and all the art history courses I took. And I'm sort of an autodidact. I'll always collect art books, and had a large influence of the pre-Raphaelite painters, that English art movement of the late 19th century, partly because of the elements of fantasy they used in their art, you know, with the medieval, the knights, and all of that, that sort of fit into a lot of comic imagery. And there are a number of people in my profession who sort of hark back to the late 19th century for art lessons.
And a lot of that has shown up in your work over the years. I mean, we talk about the heroic figures of Conan the Barbarian, Michael Moorcock's Elric, and also you've done novelizations or graphic novelizations of Mozart and Wagner, certainly a huge subjects there.
Oh, enormous. When I started listening to Wagner's Ring of the Nibelung when I was a freshman or sophomore in college, just about the time I started working in Marvel Comics, and I decided way back then that the big project of my career would be the Ring of the Nibelung, with all the gods and the heroes, the dragons, the dwarves, and all of that. So much fun stuff to draw, all in a natural setting. I love drawing trees and nature much more than buildings and cars. So, yeah, that's always been a big influence. And things like the Magic Flute, too, really lend themselves to visualization. There's so many fun, fantastical things to draw in those stories.
Well, there's certainly a lot of that going on with the book that's out now, your version of Neil Gaiman's The Graveyard book. I mean, there's so much going on in that.
Well, when you start with a setting that is based on Highgate Cemetery in London, the famous cemetery where so many literary figures are buried, which over the years, you know, in the mid-20th century, had become completely overgrown with all of these great Victorian stone sculptures of the funeral stones. That was sort of Neil Gaiman's setting for it. And it just gives you wonderful background stuff to draw. We were all researching cemeteries and making trips to cemeteries near and far just to get reference material and take pictures and get a feel for it. So, again, it's a lot of fun stuff to draw.
Neil Gaiman seems to really enjoy London for setting books. Like, I'm thinking of Neverwhere, which is an adaptation of the London Underground in a way. And with this new book, like you said, it's based around this one famous graveyard. How does an adaptation work between you and Neil Gaiman?
We've been working together for over 20 years. In that time, he's given me two original scripts, meaning scripts that were written as comics, a 30-page comic book, or as a straight-on script. The other projects we've done are ones where I adapt his prose pieces, like a novel or a short story, that were written as novels or short stories. And that's sort of like doing a screenplay from a novel or a play. You have to take that whole thing apart, line by line, edit it down. The easy stuff to edit out is when he's describing what a scene looks like, which is what a prose writer has to do to create that picture in the reader's mind. Well, we're drawing the picture, so okay, that paragraph goes because I'll just draw the picture here. So it's paring it down and then putting it back together in a way that looks seamless, like nothing is missing. And that to me is the fun part to do, because at the same time I'm writing that script, I'm designing the page with the pictures. Sometimes the pictures come first, and then I work the script around it. It's like doing a blueprint for a building. By the time you get the script and layouts, it's very much like a blueprint for, okay, now here's what we're going to draw.
It's got to be an interesting way of working, too, because like you said, you have done comics, both Marvel and DC, and in that situation, I think the script comes first, and you draw from that. But this is a whole situation where you start off with just a set of prose, mm-hmm. which probably was not conceived with the graphic novelization in mind. And then you have to take that and turn it into a comics yes. form.
Right. Actually, what you said earlier about Marvel and DC, Marvel and then DC later, you sort of had a choice. DC did finished scripts more often, but Marvel worked in a way, it was called the Marvel method, which you were given a synopsis. It might be just 3 pages long that page by page described the story, as if I would be telling you, I saw this movie last night and here's what it was about, and I told you the story. And maybe there would be a little bit of dialogue in there that the writer thought of at the time, but you had to take this synopsis and draw the story from it, and then after you had drawn it, the final script was written over your artwork. It was very much like a silent movie. You had to, and it was great training, because you had to learn how to tell a story with pictures that would be at least 75% comprehensible just by looking at it. So it was great training on telling stories with pictures. I still prefer to have a script that has every word in it that the writer wants to have in it, and then I'll tell the story with the pictures. So there are a number of ways of doing it, but that was great training then for doing an adaptation from a novel, because I'm already thinking of how is this going to work visually.
So let's talk about the current book, the Graveyard book. I mean, that's mm-hmm. got to be an odd piece to even think about turning into a graphic novel. Just the location of it, the very Britishness of the story. And it's also most of it being told from the point of view of a young kid. I mean, from an infant to teenage years there.
Right. Well, that was the challenge of the thing. There were two challenges. One was that this kid, you had to design a character that you saw at 2 years old, 4, 8, on up, and had to look like the same person growing up. And the other was, because of the size of this project, there are 8 stories in the Graveyard book, like there are 8 stories in the Jungle book. So we had different artists drawing the different stories, 8 different artists. And that's one of the reasons I did the layout, so there would be a consistency. And we had one colorist, so there would be a consistency, kind of binding all these artists together. But you have the problem of getting the other characters to remain the same, to look the same from artist to artist, and the settings, the chapel in the cemetery. And I had to make a point to let all the artists know, now this is a cemetery in the north. We had a couple artists who lived in North Carolina and Georgia, and I had to make it clear, this isn't a southern cemetery. No hanging moss or any of that. This has to look like a northern cemetery. So it's getting everybody sort of on the same page so that all the characters looked the same and the settings were the same. There was a lot of back and forth on that.
I can imagine, because just looking at the book, and this is, again, where we're going to kind of fail being on radio, but just looking through the book, anybody can really tell that there was one main hand involved in actually setting up all the pages. Like you said, all the panels, the layouts and things, mm-hmm. And that was obviously done by you. However, you could also look at the individual chapters, and you can see where the artists have a pretty strong hand mm-hmm. in putting in their own style.
Yeah, it was sort of up to me to find the artists to work on the book, and I tried to get people who worked somewhat in the same vein. But again, it's sort of like casting actors. Jill Thompson, for the last story in this first volume, I asked for her for that story, because it's a big, almost Busby Berkeley dance number that happens once every 80 years in this village, where the ghosts of the town come out of the village and dance with the villagers all night long. And nobody remembers or talks about it the next day. But she has a drawing style that's very bouncy and dance-like. And so she was cast for that story. And I tried to keep that in mind with everybody involved, to play to their strengths, at the same time using people that were not too dissimilar. There aren't wildly cartoony styles in this, or abstract styles or anything. We're all the same sort of illustrator, you could say, a lot of the same inspirations.
Now, did you find it difficult at all? Because when you are a writer, as you were in this one, writing for other artists, when over the years you've started out as an artist, having other writers do that work for you?
No, because that's the fun part to me, is laying that out. And we actually had, this was all hand lettered. So since I was doing the layouts, we had it all lettered in place, so that when they got those pages, it was pretty clear as to what goes where. They would bring their own sense of style, their own flavor to it. But no, it wasn't difficult writing it, because at the time I didn't even know who all the artists were going to be. So I just wrote for the story itself and what would work on the page, and then went out and looked for the artist.
Well, I have to say, too, the writing, in reading it, there's a lot of subtle, wry humor that you bring along. I mean, there's one part in particular where you have the ghost of the cemetery warning this young boy to be careful of a cold, damp ground. I mean, it's kind of funny. You have ghosts telling this kid, hey, watch it. You'll catch your death.
Yeah, well, that's in Neil's original story. He has that sort of wry, dry humor throughout the whole thing. And I always tried to be aware of that, pick up on it, and put it into the story in a way. And with visuals, then you can even play with it a little bit more, because you get the expressions on people's faces. You can have little bits of business going on in the background. And yes, it's there in his writing. I try to keep it in the adaptation.
People might think this is going to be a light, happy book all the way through. I mean, it starts off. I mean, yes, there's some kid stuff in it, but right from the start, this is not a kid book at all. You got some scary scenes in there.
Well, not a little kid book. It's sort of in the tweens. By the time they're in middle school, it's certainly nothing they haven't seen on TV, and probably much less in some ways. But it does start in the aftermath. You don't actually see the violence. It's the immediate aftermath of what has happened to orphan this toddler as he goes up the hill and into the cemetery. So you see the aftermath, and so you realize the danger that's there. And it's right there at the beginning. And then after that, it's quite gentle for a while until it gets into darker areas. For example, in the graveyard, there's a tendency, you know, for an artist, if you've got a graveyard, you're going to maybe make it spooky. And I told all the artists working that, no, this is his home. It's a gentle, welcoming place, and it's also a nature preserve in the story. It's not an active graveyard anymore. It hasn't been for 30 years, except for one corner of the graveyard where the ghoul gate is, and that's where it's creepy. And so that artist, I told you, get the creepy part of the cemetery, and all the others, that it's more of a nature preserve with a lot of stone statuary in it.
Does Neil Gaiman have any direct input on what we see in your version of the graveyard book?
Well, as much as he wants, but he pretty much leaves me alone to do it, because we've worked together before and he trusts my judgment in adapting his scripts. But in the beginning, he may make a couple points, like I did his short story, Murder Mysteries, that's set in Los Angeles and heaven. And at the beginning of that, he said, now don't forget, even though it's hot, it's Christmas. So there are these sort of little hints of, you know, in decorations and things, that it's actually kind of fits in with the story for a reason. But he made a point of saying, just don't forget that. And there were maybe a half a dozen questions I had while I was scripting and adapting this over a 3-month period. And I would call or send a message and ask a little bit about a plot point or sort of Britishism that's in there as to a little more information. And he always gets right back. So he's there if I need him, but he lets me alone to do it.
One thing we haven't mentioned is that this is just volume one of the Graveyard book. And whose decision was it to end volume one with a serious sense of dread that just you just can't wait to get to volume two?
both of us, in a sense, in the original novel, which is all in one volume. That's called The Interlude, and it's right in the middle. And since it has that sort of edge to it, it was just a natural to put it at the end of this book, that it gives you that sense that, no, this story isn't complete, and there's a lot more to come, and it's going to get a lot more dangerous for our hero. So it was just sort of a cliffhanger and a natural place to put it. It's the shortest one. It's 4 pages, and it's just a conversation between all of these men who look quite respectable, and they're really totally awful.
So volume 2 is coming out when?
I think in September, so it's going to be pretty soon, but I don't have the exact date.
And do you have a roster of artists working for this one as well?
Oh, it's all completely done. I mean, everybody was working at the same time. So it was done just about the same time as the first volume was, because they had to have everything done for the printing. But what did happen is that working with other artists, and I got to say, I got a lot more respect for art directors and production managers, because I was sort of put in that seat. And you're working with other people, you're kind of at their mercy. So one artist had to be helped out in finishing his book, and another artist, 5 months after the deadline, I said, you got to go. And it was the very last story in the book. So within 3 weeks, I and Galen Showman, who's one of the artists in the book, took this 22-page story, divided it up. I did 11 pages, he did 11, and then we sent it to an inker to do the final ink line, Kevin Nolan, who drew the first story in the first book. So the three of us together in 3 weeks did the 22-page story. And because we were all artists in the book and had similar styles, it had a very consistent look to it and actually ended the book in a way that fit with the beginning of the book. So you have these things happen at the last time because you're dealing with people. And I have to say, out of altogether 9 artists involved, 7 were great and only 2 were problematic. So that's a pretty good record.
So it's the same bunch of people working on Volume 2 as well?
Yes. Scott Hampton has the biggest story in the book, and it's 100 pages long. And he stepped in to finish off one of the stories in the first volume. You'll see his name in the credits. And then another artist who lives overseas did the first story in the second volume. And he's the one I cast because I knew he did teenagers and their fashions really well and was good with architecture. And this is the one where Bod goes into back to civilization too soon, and he goes to school. So it's in like a junior high school. And this guy did it all on computer. All the rest of us are still doing it the old-fashioned way, you know, lines on paper, hard copy. But he created his entirely on, you know, this computer sketch pads and stuff. And you can't tell the difference visually one from the other at all. It's just a different way to do it. But he's the only one that there's no hard copy of that artwork existing.
Well, I'm looking forward to seeing Volume 2 of the Graveyard book. I tell you, it was a fun read, and I'm looking forward to it. We've been speaking with P. Craig Russell, who adapted Neil Gaiman's The Graveyard book into a fantastic graphic novel. Thanks very much for speaking with us.
It was a pleasure talking to you.
And for Around Cincinnati, I'm Frank Johnson.